Good morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. Tear gas has again wafted through the streets of central Athens, with violent clashes occurring between police and protesters, angry over the latest wave of austerity measures. More pay cuts and tax hikes are in store in exchange for continuing support from the international community. The pain doesn't stop there. Greece is planning to sell off $5.5 billion of state assets to help pay its way. Europe correspondent Rachel Brown reports.
Protesters have clashed with riot police on the steps of Parliament and set fire to a guard's sentry box. They've hurled Molotov cocktails and chunks of marble ripped from buildings with hammers and crowbars. Police have responded with tear gas and stun guns. The 100,000-strong protest marks the start of a two-day strike that has crippled flights and public transport and closed schools and tourist attractions. The Greek government says Greece is fighting for survival and striking workers are blackmailing the country. To secure its next slice of bailout funding, Greece has to convince the other Eurozone countries and the IMF it's tackling its mountain of debt. The Greek finance minister, Evangelos Venizelos, says the country has no choice but to swallow the bitter pill. In the name of our history and our dignity, he says, we need to end this transitional period of the reduced fiscal sovereignty. The government's under immense pressure from abroad to speed up reform, to avoid a Greek default that would spread panic through international markets. Stavros Lambrinidis is the Greek foreign minister.
Look at the fact that about 100,000 public service employees have left and not been replaced in only 1 year. Look at the fact that I have cut salaries and cut pensions in a way that is extremely painful for many people who were not directly responsible for the debts and the deficits. Look at the fact that I've, at the same time in only 1 year, rehauled the pension system in Greece.
But citizens argue change needs to be slow or their economy will die. Living standards are falling sharply and unemployment is close to 17%. The union's 48-hour strike is the last stand before a weekend EU crisis summit in Brussels. The European Commission President Jose Manuel Barroso says the EU is at a critical moment.
Without Greece creating confidence in the investors that it can come back to a path of sustainability, it will not have the necessary confidence. And without confidence, there will be no investment and no jobs.
It's been nearly 18 months since Greece received its first bailout, but given its debt is forecast to climb to around $480 billion this year, Greece remains at the top of the EU's agenda. This is Rachel Brown in London reporting for AM.
The competition watchdog says it'll seek new laws to deal with the price war between Coles and Woolworths if it feels it doesn't have enough power to stop misleading or predatory behaviour. The new head of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, Rod Sims, has told a Senate committee in Canberra that he'll be keeping a close eye on the supermarket sector. But some opposition and independent senators have again questioned if the ACCC is doing enough to protect suppliers to the supermarkets, such as dairy farmers. From Canberra, Naomi Woodley reports.
Earlier this month, Rod Sims flagged a more aggressive approach to pursuing possible breaches of competition law. At a Senate estimates hearing in Canberra last night, he explained what he meant.
Where we judge that there is consumer detriment and there's been a breach of the law, we'll be taking action and backing our judgment in those cases, even if the law is not completely clear. I'm not suggesting we'll be taking on marginal cases and hoping we get up on a few. And it doesn't mean that on every occasion we'll be going to court. We'll still, of course, be using our undertakings and infringement notices.
But the National Senator John Williams has questioned how that'll be applied to the price war between the major supermarkets Coles and Woolworths.
In the last year, we have seen the milk war rage, which will ultimately be a war borne by the dairy farmers. The major chains have simply raised the price of other lines to make up the difference, which has been reported. What is the ACCC doing to stop domination in the grocery sector other than saying they will stop it?
Mr Sims reiterated that it's clear the two retailers have significant market power, and he says their actions are being closely watched.
What, of course, we really need is for people to come forward with complaints with the appropriate evidence.
But he says the extent of the Commission's powers is somewhat unclear.
I think the question of whether or not we have the power is something we really need to test a bit. I think it's a sector we need to keep a close eye on. I think we need to see how it goes. And as I said in my opening remarks, if we find that if we form the view that we need more power, then we'll be politely saying so.
In July, the ACCC found no evidence that Coles' decision to discount its milk prices was against the law. Mr Sims says there's a high hurdle to pass under the current Act.
The way the Section 46 is drafted is it's not stopping somebody using price as a competitive weapon. It's stopping somebody using predatory pricing for the purpose of damaging or preventing competition. It's actually quite a hurdle.
Have a look what they're doing to the small milk vendors in country towns. Corner shops. Have a look what Coles and, of course, Woolworths matching them are doing that when it comes to damaging competition.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear as nose on your face.
The Independent Senator Nick Xenophon has his own concerns.
Isn't it potentially misleading if Coles is heavily advertising the discounting of 6,000 products but putting out the prices on 15,000 others? Couldn't that be potentially misleading to consumers?
The ACCC says it depends on the overall impression made by a particular statement, but it says if it finds evidence of misleading behaviour, then it will take action.
Naomi Woodley reporting. A massive coal mining project in central Queensland has set off a debate about the future of one of the nation's land conservation schemes. If approved, Clive Palmer's Galilee Basin proposal will be the first mine to be allowed in a nature refuge. Half of the area involves an open cut mine, the other section would be significantly affected by longwall mining. That's horrified the owners who signed over the land as a reserve in the belief it would be protected forever. Here's Matt Wordsworth.
Clive Palmer's Waratah Coal plans on exporting 40 million tonnes of coal a year from the Galilee Basin project, earning about $4.6 billion per annum. It would also inject about $1 billion annually into the coffers of the Queensland and federal governments. Kelly Naidu, who owns a hotel in the nearest town of Alpha, hopes it gets the green light.
There's nothing else here. Agriculture has never done anything besides making landholders rich, you know, I mean, and it's only one or two individuals. When you look at mining is, you know, giving the whole country a boost.
Standing in its way is the Bimblebox Nature Refuge, set up by local landowner Paola Cassoni.
We've seen a lot of land clearing, and probably Central West and Central Queensland was the worst, had the worst land clearing rate of Australia. And so we decided to buy a property and to secure it from land clearing. So property was Bimblebox.
A nature refuge is a voluntary but legally binding agreement between the state government and a landholder, which preserves land with significant conservation values. But Waratah Coal's environmental impact statement says that 52% of the refuge would become an open-cut mine, and the remaining 48% could be affected by subsidence from longwall mining.
Bimblebox apparently would cease to exist.
Queensland's Department of Environment website states that the intent of a nature refuge agreement is permanent protection, and termination would only be enacted under exceptional circumstances. Paola Cassoni is concerned the mine will create a precedent for the destruction of other refuges and discourage landowners from taking part in the scheme.
Mine is the first one that goes under the chop, if you like. There is another 54, I think, for exploration / mining lease for coal, and another 50 for other minerals. So when the state says, oh, we protect the nature refuges forever for future generations, well, what does that mean?
Professor Hugh Possingham is an environmental scientist from the University of Queensland. He says nature refuges are not just a state government instrument, but are also regarded as part of the national reserve system.
And some of these nature reserves we're talking about, like Bimblebox, have extraordinarily high conservation value, and they would be really class 1 or 2 nature reserves by international standards.
Waratah Coal has promised to preserve a parcel of land in the region that is twice the size of Bimblebox and of equal ecological value. But Professor Possingham has concerns about this model.
That just guarantees that you're going to destroy half of all habitat type. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
A spokesman for Clive Palmer declined the ABC's request for an interview. The state Environment Minister was not available, and the Federal Environment Minister, Tony Burke, issued a statement saying, "I understand there is some community concern around the proposed development. The proposal is now open for public comment. I encourage the community to be part of this process."
Matt Wordsworth reporting. You're listening to AM Around Australia on ABC Radio National, where it's 20 minutes past 7. Internationally, we're being heard on Radio Australia. The Defence Department is conducting a massive overhaul of its top security clearances because of revelations that up to 20,000 security checks may have been compromised. Earlier this year, three whistleblowers told the ABC that information contained in thousands of security checks had been fabricated to speed up the vetting process. Some of these people were applying for jobs which would give them access to sensitive military and political institutions. The opposition claims the breaches could jeopardise Australia's national security. Michael Edwards has this report.
The Defence Security Authority isn't a high-profile organisation, but it has a serious role to play in Australia's national security. It does security checks on people applying for a number of government jobs, ranging from security guards at military bases to senior public servants with access to sensitive information. Between 2009 and 2010, Monica Bennett-Ryan was employed by the DSA.
On any given day, we'd take the applications and process the information that is written into them. At first, we used to reject those that didn't have the appropriate information, send them back to the applicant, but the rules changed and we were then told that we needed to process everything, and if the information was not forthcoming, that we should enter a substitute into the database.
Monica Bennett-Ryan says the false information represented a serious security breach.
The information that we put in, whether it was true or false, once it was entered, couldn't be checked by anyone else down the line unless we flagged it as a problem, which we were not taught to do because we were told that this was correct procedure and this was the normal thing to do. But unless we did that, further down the track, people like ASIO would not be able to tell that the information that we put into the database was actually false.
Yesterday, in a Senate hearing, the opposition alleged that three senior Labor ministers were told of the problems back in 2010, but had failed to take action. The hearing also heard that 20,000 security clearances will have to be rechecked. 5,000 of these are at the top security level. The opposition defence spokesman, David Johnson, says he's almost too frightened to think about the possible ramifications.
We have embassies, foreign dignitaries, all coming to Australia, all being the subject of people with security clearances, doing rudimentary and fundamental jobs like, servicing the aircraft and doing all these sorts of things. It is very concerning that this problem has come to the point that it has because it was ignored for so long.
A spokesman for the Defence Minister, Stephen Smith, says that Senator Johnston's assertions are baseless and the government has taken the matter very seriously since the allegations were first raised. Neil James from the Australia Defence Association says the root cause of the problem is the desire to save money.
In the old days when the Army, Navy and Air Force were responsible for the security of their own bases and also for the vetting of people who worked on them, things ran a bit more efficiently. But when you contract things out to save money, or when you civilianise them in the public service, inevitably there is an operational problem further down the track.
The Inspector General of Intelligence and Security is presently preparing a report into the breaches.
Michael Edwards reporting there. A former high-flying IBM sales executive has told AM that the company ignored her allegations of sexual harassment and bullying by a senior manager for nearly 2 years. Last week, IBM lost a court bid to have details of the case suppressed. Susan Spiteri's lawyers say more harassment and bullying cases taken out by IBM staff are in the pipeline. IBM says it doesn't tolerate harassment and it will vigorously defend the case. With more, here's Sue Lannan.
Susan Spiteri started work at IBM in Melbourne in 1999. She was one of the computer company's top salespeople on a salary of $150,000.
IBM was my life. I loved my job. I loved my customers. I loved my job. I loved what I did. It was my identity.
But Susan Spiteri says that all changed in 2007 when a new manager was appointed. In a statement of claim lodged in the federal court, she alleges she was sexually harassed and bullied for nearly 2 years by the man who was her supervisor.
He groped me. He rubbed himself against my backside when he walked past me. He touched me put his hands up my dress, asked me to expose my breasts to get more sales. He called me names to my customers and customers and advised me of that. He yelled at me consistently.
In court documents, Ms. Spiteri says she repeatedly complained to her managers at IBM, but they took no action.
My colleagues were all supportive, but they were all too scared to do anything about it. They would see me crying nearly every day at my desk.
The statement of claim alleges that Ms. Spiteri made a formal complaint to IBM in May 2009 and the company did an investigation. The document says the senior manager resigned in August that year after IBM put the allegations to him. Ms. Spiteri told AM the man was then assigned by the company to be one of her customers. Susan Spiteri left IBM in late 2009. Now 42, she says the experience has taken a huge toll on her life.
I've had a severe breakdown. I had that working at work. I did try to take my life a couple of times.
What are you hoping to get out of this court action?
To get a resolution so that I can try and move forward. I want to encourage other victims of sexual harassment and bullying to be strong and come forward.
AM asked IBM to respond to the allegations in the case. In a statement, an IBM spokesperson said,
IBM does not tolerate harassment of any type. The claimant remains an employee of IBM and continues to receive comprehensive benefits and support. The person against whom the harassment allegations were made left IBM 2 years ago. We will vigorously defend ourselves in court.
Employment lawyer Siobhan Keating from Maurice Blackburn Lawyers is representing Susan Spiteri. She says there are several other complaints relating to different people at IBM.
Since the action against IBM was made public earlier this year, we've had a significant number of people come forward and speak to us about those sorts of issues, and there are now a number of cases on foot against IBM.
IBM refused to comment on whether other staff members had made complaints.
Sue Lannan. Police in the Midwestern US state of Ohio have shot and killed dozens of big game animals that were set free from a private zoo. The bizarre case terrified the local community, with authorities ordering people to stay indoors as they hunted the tigers, lions, grizzly bears and other predators in the dark. The local county sheriff is being criticised by animal rights groups for ordering his deputies to shoot to kill, but he says he had no choice. North America correspondent Craig McMurtry reports.
Sheriff Matt Lutz of Muskingum County might have imagined hunting escaped prisoners one day, but not this.
There are 48 animals that we had to put down. Those animals included one wolf, six black bears, two grizzly bears, nine male lions, eight lionesses, one baboon, three mountain lions, and 18 tigers.
It's not the wilds of Africa, it's eastern Ohio. But in a Noah's Ark horror story, the residents of this community are being told to stay indoors because some of the animal world's most dangerous predators are on the loose.
Scary. You don't know where they're at.
We hear weird noises every once in a while, and we just try to figure out what it was. It's not a domestic animal or anything like that.
Deputies rushed to a private animal park after panicked residents started reporting big cats and bears were wandering around. They found the owner, colourful local identity Terry Thompson, dead in an apparent suicide. Sheriff Lutz says before killing himself, he released all 56 of his prized big game.
I had deputies that had to shoot animals with their sidearms at close range. That's how volatile this situation was.
Ohio has some of America's weakest regulations on keeping exotic animals. Observers say conditions at the farm were deplorable. The local sheriff was unapologetic about choosing to gun them down instead of tranquilizing them.
I gave the order on the way here that if animals looked like they were going out, they went down. We could not have animals running loose in this county.
And U.S. television wildlife host Jack Hanna backed the sheriff's call.
The sheriff did the right thing. I know we have animal rights groups giving me threatening calls right now, all sorts of things. My gosh, Jack Hanna's saying this. What was he to do at nighttime with tigers and lions, leopards going out there?
Schools were closed as locals in the normally quiet community reported seeing camels grazing at the side of the road and hearing lions roaring. And Matt Lutz says the grizzly hunt isn't over.
There are two missing animals at this time, one being a gray wolf and one being a monkey.
The owner had just been released after spending a year in prison over federal firearms violations, but no one knows why he decided to let them loose. This is Craig McMurtry for AM.
To the financial markets now, and in New York, the Dow Jones closed at 11,505 points, down 72 points. The Nasdaq was down 53 points. The dollar buying 102.1 US cents, 74.3 euro cents. I'm Tony Eastley. That's AM for today.